Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Most chronic diseases, from cardiovascular disease to diabetes to strokes, are in decline, but deaths due to Alzheimer's disease has increased by nearly 87% in the last decade, and things could get worse. 10% of people older than 65 will develop some form of dementia. People over the age of 85 have a 50% chance of developing the disease. The cost of managing this disease are expected to reach $266 billion in the United States just this year. The demands of the disease could crash our healthcare and financial systems. While billions of dollars are being poured into clinical drug trials that have yet to lead to a cure, today's guests, Drs. Dean and Aisha Sherzai, two neurologists at Loma Linda University in California, have studied the impacts of lifestyle changes on the development of dementia and Alzheimer's for years. And based on scientific research and work with thousands of patients, they argue that 90% of Alzheimer's cases could be prevented or turned around with lifestyle changes. That is 90%. In their new book, The Alzheimer's Solution, they show how our brains are directly affected by nutrition, exercise, sleep, stress, and social engagement. Their research has led them to develop the NeuroPlan. It's a comprehensive lifestyle adjustment, and that stands for nutrition, exercise, unwind, restore, and optimize. They write, quote, "Even with a diagnosis, you can reverse cognitive decline and add vibrant years to your life. The future of your brain is finally within your control," end quote. Aisha and Dean Sherzai are co-directors of the Brain Health and Alzheimer's Prevention Program at Loma Linda University. Dr. Aisha Sherzai is a neurologist. She leads the lifestyle program for the prevention of neurological diseases. And Dr. Dean Sherzai trained in neurology at Georgetown University and also holds a PhD in healthcare leadership with a focus on community health. And Drs. Aisha and Dean Sherzai join us from Southern California. Hi, thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having us, Rose.
Thank you.
Thank you, and really huge respect for writing this important book. You dedicate the book to your grandfathers. You write, they're the greatest men you've ever known. And your grandfathers struggled with dementia at the end of their lives. How did your grandfathers steer you toward researching brain health? Aisha, do you want to start first?
Sure. It was, as some people can imagine, it's a devastating disease to be a part of. We saw this incredible man, my grandfather, who was a role model for everyone in the family, slowly and gradually lose parts of himself to the point where he couldn't recognize anyone around him. And for such a figure to go through this painful journey, it shaped our futures in many ways. And I was intrigued by it. I was intrigued by the mind, by the brain. And going into neurology, I trained in preventive medicine and neurology at Loma Linda University and then at Columbia University for a vascular neurology fellowship. You know, it's a very depressing field to be in because there's no treatment for Alzheimer's disease, and yet there's so much research and data on prevention, and that's how we got into it.
Dean, what about you? What would you add?
Same thing. I mean, for us, both of us, I think that was the landmark moment. In fact, at the time, we didn't know that, but looking back, we realized that that was the moment when we first recognized the deficit in our grandfathers. The moment when he was playing chess with the grandchildren and he didn't know how to move a knight. I mean, something as simple as that, where the whole family was taken aback. That prompted our journey, and that's where we are now, trying to figure out a path beyond what has been going on for the last 30 years, which is 100% failure in research.
And when you look at these statistics, I mean, they're just shocking. As you point out, the deaths due to Alzheimer's disease have increased by 87% just in the last decade. People over the age of 85 have a 50% chance of developing the disease. So let's just talk about some basic facts about Alzheimer's. You have some great graphics in your book. You point out that The past 100 or so years of research have yielded these facts about Alzheimer's. It's a progressive disease of the brain that impairs memory, thinking, mood, and problem solving. It's one type of dementia that accounts for 60 to 80% of dementia cases. And the majority of patients notice the symptoms in their mid-60s to early 70s. Aisha, what else do we need to know? Just basic facts about Alzheimer's.
I'd like to highlight the fact that women are suffering more from this disease than men. Two-thirds of all Alzheimer's patients are women. And as it happens, two-thirds of all caregivers, you know, people who take care of their loved ones day in and day out, are women as well. And loved ones or the spouse or the person who's living with the Alzheimer's patient actually has a 600% higher risk of developing the disease compared to the rest of the population. And that in itself tells us that, you know, it can't be genetics. So it has to be lifestyle, because when you live with someone, you share the same lifestyle pattern. You share the same sleep pattern, food pattern, going out, moving around, physical activity, and so on and so forth. That actually prompts us to look at the elements that surround us each and every day and try to figure out, you know, what they are and change them to have better brain health and to stave off this devastating disease.
One other fact, Dean, is that, as you both report in your book, Alzheimer's is grossly underreported on death certificates, making it likely the third leading cause of death in the United States. Yet we don't really hear that much. We hear a lot about cancer and other forms of cancers. But we're starting to hear more about Alzheimer's, but definitely not that it's likely the third leading cause of death in this country.
Well, it's actually on its way to becoming number one. In most first world nations, it is number one. In UK, it's number one. In Japan, it's number one. And you said it, the proportion of people that suffer from Alzheimer's is exponentially growing, and death from Alzheimer's is exponentially growing. Why is this disparity of reporting? Because people usually die from conditions that are secondarily caused by Alzheimer's, meaning what they call apraxia, forgetting how to swallow, forgetting how to breathe, or not so much cognitively forgetting, but the body loses that capacity. So when the person ends up with pneumonia and dies in the hospital from pneumonia, they say pneumonia, but it was actually caused primarily from Alzheimer's, or falls secondary to inability to walk anymore. And they say that the person died from falls, but it's actually falls directly caused by Alzheimer's. That's why it's profoundly underreported. And where it's underreported even more is in certain populations, minority populations, where people live with this disease and they die with this disease never being diagnosed. So the numbers say 5.8 million people have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's today in the United States. Every 66 seconds, somebody is diagnosed. That number doesn't come close to truly reflecting the catastrophe that we're facing right now. The tsunami is not in the future. It is today.
So why are these numbers going up so drastically? What explains that?
Two factors. One is the fact that the population is aging. And aging by itself doesn't mean that you should develop the disease. But aging the way we are now in the United States and most first world countries, with trauma of bad food, with trauma of cumulative inflammation, with trauma of all these things that happen to us in life in a bad way, without us actively opposing those lifestyle factors, the risk goes up, you know, just by nature of numbers. The second factor is there is more bad food, and there's much more distance between people, so there's less communication. People do not experience the social activity necessary for brain to be active. Mm-hmm. And all the other environmental factors that we're facing in the 21st century, these two factors are by themselves enough to cause significant trauma in this incredibly complex system, which is our body. Now, multiply that exponentially when it comes to the brain.
So talk to us about how you both decided to really look at lifestyle, because, you know, as you write in your book, and I'd love to talk about this in a minute, your mentors told you that if you studied lifestyle, you would be risking your careers and your reputations. And so many of us have this experience where we go to the doctor, they never ask us what we ate that day, or they never ask us, did you get a good night's sleep, or how much do you sleep? So how did you both go down this lifestyle path?
I think it started when we were both at UCSD, University of California, San Diego. Dean was a fellow, and UCSD was the number one program in neurodegenerative diseases, like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease. And he was training to become a dementia specialist, and I was a student in the Master's of Clinical Research program. And we were both, you know, involved in research, and I used to work in a lab. And, you know, day in and day out as a research associate or assistant, you go to the clinic and you interact with these lovely patients and lovely families who are completely discombobulated by the pain that this disease is causing. And all we saw was very fancy diagnostic tools, you know, functional MRIs and MRIs and blood tests and so on and so forth. And at the end of the day, the patient was given a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. And I remember clearly a stack of nursing home pamphlets on the table that was being pushed to the family, and they were told that, you know, you need to make some decisions, some really difficult decisions moving on, because there is really no treatment for this disease, and that's it. You know, try to live your life as happy as you can, and that's basically it. And it was just depressing. And also, the research kept on coming back over and over again, you know, multiple clinical trials on animal models and, you know, on very advanced technological tools showing the same thing, that, you know, the medication didn't work or the techniques didn't work. And, you know, in our minds, we were looking and reading and being parts of journal clubs, and you kept on looking at the failure over and over again. And we thought to ourselves, there has to be something else. There has to be something else that we can do. And so, you know, when you reach a point where you see the failure over and over again, you start exploring other things. And so we started reading about, you know, prevention models and what everybody else was doing. And little did we know that, you know, a few miles away from San Diego, there was a place called Loma Linda. And Loma Linda happened to be a blue zone. Our friend Dan Buettner wrote about it. The blue zones are areas around the world where people have longevity. They experience longevity. They have the least incidence and prevalence of chronic disease of aging. And so we read about this and we were intrigued. And so, you know, one thing led to another, and we were exposed to research by the likes of Dr. Paul Guillaume from Loma Linda University, Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn, who's a cardiologist, a surgeon at, you know, Cleveland Clinic, who wrote the book Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease, by Dr. Colin Campbell, who wrote the China study. And, you know, this whole new world of a prevention model started expanding. And for a long time, we were kicking ourselves and saying, you know, why were we never exposed to such great research in medical school? Why were we never told about this? And one thing led to another, and we chose to go to Loma Linda. And that's when Dean actually encountered that conversation with one of his mentors, saying, if you want to go to lifestyle, that's career suicide, because you will never get a grant. You know, you have to have a molecular model. You have to follow what everybody else is doing, because then if you don't, you're going to be ostracized. But I think that was one of the best decisions that we made, and that's how we ended up there, and that's why we're here now.
Just to expand on that just a little bit more, it's we know that lifestyle works in other fields. In fact, there's no question. Primary prevention is the word that people use. Primary prevention of heart disease, meaning that before heart disease ever develops. Primary prevention of strokes. Primary prevention of cancers. That's been accepted worldwide. And so unless the brain was planted into our head by aliens, which I don't think that's the case, it works on the same models. But what we found is actually it's even more resilient than those organs because of the what's called cognitive reserve, the ability of the brain to grow exponentially, in fact, 30,000 times as far as function is concerned. So that gives it even more resilience and more protection if you give it the right environment, if you give it the right resources, even more than primary prevention of heart disease, more than primary prevention of cancers. So that's what the wonderful news is. That organ that makes us who we are, that organ that is us, has the ability to recover. Now, one thing I want to make sure that we don't go without clarifying. We, unlike some other people, never say that once the fulminant disease is on board, meaning that the person has full-blown Alzheimer's, that you can reverse it. There's data that you can slow it down, but we would never say something like that. We would have sold millions of other more books if we had said that, but that's irresponsible. What we do say is that early in the process, at mild cognitive impairment stage, or even earlier, if you take on this challenge in a more complex way, not through little vitamin concoctions or protocols, mm-hmm. but a more comprehensive lifestyle, not only do you avoid this disease and other diseases like stroke in your lifetime, but you'll maintain profound cognitive health well into your 80s, 90s, and beyond. That's the beauty of this.
Today, we are speaking with Drs. Dean and Aisha Sherzai about their new book, The Alzheimer's Solution, a breakthrough program to prevent and reverse the symptoms of cognitive decline at every age. They are co-directors of the Brain Health and Alzheimer's Prevention Program at Loma Linda University Medical Center in Southern California. Based on the research that they've done, the scientific research they've read, their work with thousands of patients, they say 90% of Alzheimer's cases could be prevented or turned around with lifestyle changes. And if you have any questions for Drs. Sherzai, we'd love to hear from you. If you have a loved one living with Alzheimer's or dementia, or if you're experiencing some kind of anxiety or depression, we'd love to hear from you. What are the recommendations your doctor told you? If you have a family history of Alzheimer's, what have you been told about your chances of developing the disease? And if you have a personal story to share, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Can you elaborate more on the 90% of cases could be prevented? Because that is just, what a high number. Aisha, can you elaborate on that?
Sure. So the reason we say that 90% can be prevented is because when you look at the, let's just start from here. When you look at the genetic model of Alzheimer's disease, because, you know, almost everybody feels that if their grandmother or grandfather or mother or father had Alzheimer's disease, then they do have the genetic proclivity for having that disease. And almost everyone attributes Alzheimer's disease to a genetic model. True, you know, we are made of genes, and a lot of diseases, or almost all diseases, have a genetic component. But the genetics of Alzheimer's disease is presented in a way where only about 3 to 5% of Alzheimer's disease is heavily driven by genes. There are three main genetic patterns. They're called presenilin 1, presenilin 2, and APP, or amyloid precursor protein, which drives Alzheimer's disease in a way where, you know, no matter what you do in life, you're going to develop it, and you're going to develop it early. But for the rest of it, 90%+ of Alzheimer's disease, the genes are lifestyle genes. They are genes that are responsible for how your brain metabolizes cholesterol, how your brain and body gets rid of waste byproducts, how your brain is, in many ways created to block immune attacks to it. So how strong your brain is to withstand all the damage that it faces on a regular basis for 90% of the population. So if we have those genetic patterns that makes us weaker when it comes to, say, inflammation or to immune responses, we just got to take really good care of ourselves and not put ourselves in a situation where that inflammation or that lipid or fat metabolism or the abnormal glucose metabolism techniques affect our brain. What does that mean on a day-to-day basis? It means that we just need to be really careful about what we eat. We need to exercise as much as possible. We need to make sure that we don't miss on sleep, because sleep is the time when the brain cleanses itself. We need to make sure that we keep our minds active, not just by, you know, silly games on our phones, but to be involved in real life, complex and challenging activities. And the disease doesn't start overnight. Mm. These small brain pathological processes start at least 20 to 30 years before the manifestation of the symptoms happen. And so if you live a very healthy, cognitively vibrant life during your, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s, you're absolutely going to be able to prevent 90% of, you know, Alzheimer's disease, even if you have the risk factors and the genetic factors for it.
And we say within normal life, which is 80 to 85 years of age. Mm-hmm. And that's not a controversial statement. I mean, just moving it back 5 years will do that. That's the secret.
And can you elaborate on what Aisha said, Dean? I think this is so important, that Alzheimer's develops decades before a diagnosis. You write, it's during those decades that the brain becomes increasingly vulnerable to what we eat, how much we exercise, our ability to manage chronic stress, the quality of our sleep, and the ways in which we challenge our cognitive abilities. So let's say we're in our mid-30s and mid-40s, and we work a lot, we don't think we need much sleep, and we're always on the go, always on social media. What we're doing today will affect what happens to our lifestyle and our brains when we're in our 60s and 70s?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's difficult to give this message to younger people because they think they're immortal. You know, that's not... But it starts early. It's the two processes. One is you have to maintain a fabulous environment for the brain to grow, meaning that the environment cannot be toxic. It cannot have too much cholesterol, too much or bad kind of sugar, or toxins for that matter, because then forget about growth. That will never happen. Once you've created that environment through nutrition, sleep, and we'll talk about the importance of things like sleep and stress management, then the other two activities, such as exercise and mental activity and social activity, give the brain the ability to grow. Now, the profound fact here is that if you don't do these things, it goes in the other direction. Whereas a group of people actually are continuing to grow brain, others, the majority who are not doing the necessary things, are actually having shrinkage of the brain and accumulation of pathology. That's how profound the difference there is. And that's why we see a small percentage of people that are in their 80s and 90s and beyond, and it has nothing to do with genetics or very little to do with genetics, but they are vibrant, mentally active, you know, cognitively involved in their communities. They're leaders of their communities. And it's because if you look at their history, they've done all these right things. And that's why when we went to Loma Linda, we looked at these individuals that are in their 90s and they're community leaders and they're sharp as anybody. Mm-hmm. That difference happens early on. But even later in life, because of the connectivity, we have about 87 billion neurons. That's a lot of neurons. And it's not the number of neurons that's as important as the fact that these neurons, each of them can make a few connections or as many as 30,000 connections.
Wow.
And that it's not that we'd grow new neurons if we do all this. That's not the... But we can make these connections. And these connections are more than just protection. These connections, 87 billion neurons making thousands of connections, that's continual cognitive prowess well into your, you know, late 90s and beyond. And you can do that even later in life. So even if you haven't started it early, which would have been better, and if you started in your 60s and 70s, you can actually protect yourself. That's the power. And by the way, you don't have to buy a blue vitamin jellyfish pill, from TV, or a combination of vitamins. We have patients that come with bags of vitamins and none of that. Unless you're deficient in vitamins, taking extra vitamins has never been shown to be of any benefit. Or some superfood, you know, you can eat all the blueberries you want, but if you're eating bad food the rest of the time, you're not doing any benefit to yourself. So it has to be a more complex approach, which is real life in your home, in your communities, and at your work.
Today we are speaking with Drs. Dean and Aisha Sherzai about their new book, The Alzheimer's Solution, a breakthrough program to prevent and reverse the symptoms of cognitive decline at every age. They are co-directors of the Brain Health and Alzheimer's Prevention Program at Loma Linda University Medical Center in Southern California. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about how the laws and policies that enabled the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II are resurfacing today. We'll talk about a new film, And Then They Came for Us. People who were incarcerated tell their stories and speak out against the Muslim travel ban. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can send us an email, yourcall@kalw.com. www.aisha.org. Today we are speaking with Doctors Dean and Aisha Sherzai about their new book, The Alzheimer Solution, a breakthrough program to prevent and reverse the symptoms of cognitive decline at every age. They are co-directors of the Brain Health and Alzheimer's Prevention Program at Loma Linda University Medical Center. And you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We have an email from Susan who says, "For the past 9 months, I have been dealing with extreme anxiety and depression. I am no longer cooking or driving, and I've, for the most part, isolated myself. My neurologist recently told me that I have the APOE4 gene, and I need to change my lifestyle, but other than giving me a drug, he wasn't specific. I still lack motivation, and I'm not sure where to take it at this point."
This is one of my favorite questions. I want you to be patient. It's got three parts, but I think when we go over the three parts, it's going to help so many people. So it's depression is an anxiety, for that matter. It's a continuum, or sometimes it's incredibly debilitating. I mean, one of our least favorite words, in fact, the least favorite word in English language for me and Aisha, is motivation. Mm-hmm. There's a judgment in that, as if to say that since you're not motivated, you're not like the rest of us. There is no, throw away that word. Motivation means nothing. Here's a functional way as far as motivation is concerned. You create a clear goal, an achievable goal. You create small steps of success toward that goal. And if you do this on a repetitive basis over several weeks, the brain actually labels it. Either it likes it or it doesn't. And if you're successful, it likes it. By doing that several times or multiple times, you actually create a direction and a vector. That direction to that behavior is motivation. Here, for the first time, a functional definition of motivation. So a clear direction, steps of success towards it with emotion that comes with it. That's the motivation. So there is that. Don't worry about motivation. We'll work on that. Now, anxiety and depression can be debilitating. In fact, it's one of the things that devastates the largest number of people in first world countries. And it does come as a result of many chronic diseases. But a lot of times it's the cause of them. So whenever people talk to me about APOE4 or they ask me whether they should do genetic testing, I say absolutely not, especially not in the unless it's in research setting. But outside of that, if you find out you have the APOE4, then what? Do they have a cure for it? No. Aisha and I have both had two grandparents each mm-hmm. that have had Alzheimer's. That means that we probably are at risk. And there's probably either one allele of APOE4 we got or two. Now, right now, I'm 52, and I forget a lot of things. But that's been the case for many years, and I lose things. And the joke in the clinic is Dr. Sherzai is a memory specialist, and he loses more coats than anybody else. Now, up to now, every time I lose things, and I've been losing things for decades, I just ascribe it to being busy, being overwhelmed, you know, all of these things. But the moment if I find out that I have APOE4 gene, guess what happens? I'm going to ascribe it to, or I'm going to contribute, say that it's related to my genes and mm-hmm. it's the beginnings of Alzheimer's. And that creates anxiety, and then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I tell people, forget about the APOE4 gene, because assume you have it and live to protect yourself. And I'll tell you why. APOE4, if you have one gene, it increases your risk four times. If you have two, that means one allele from each parent, your risk goes up as much as 12 or more times. But even people who have two, which is just 2% of the population, two genes, not all of them develop Alzheimer's. In fact, 50% don't. And population studies from places like Nigeria and other places have shown us that the genes were not the factor. It was lifestyle. So the same people that had the genes in one area when they had good health, good lifestyles, they didn't develop the disease. But when they came to US, guess what happened? Or if they developed bad habits, guess what happened? They developed it. So genes just increase your risk. So I tell people, assume you have all the bad genes risks, don't check your genetics, and live in a way that protects you against them. And there is evidence, there's profound amount of evidence that we've written in our book, more than 300 citations and more, that lifestyle can significantly protect you even in the face of genes. So throw away the APOE4 diagnosis. That's nothing. We probably all have it, but at least Aisha and I probably have one of them. And lifestyle can protect you against it and start doing that. And the other part of a lifestyle when it comes to anxiety and depression, do you know that exercise by itself has been shown to reduce your risk of curtail symptoms of anxiety and depression more than any drug out there, more than any SSRI or SNRIs, such as Prozac and others, than any of those drugs out there. So exercise is one of your best tools to both fight against anxiety and depression and against dementia and others. So how do you start exercise when you have no motivation? Throw away motivation. Create a small goal. In our program, we talk about don't do the New Year resolution. Every New Year resolution fails. Create a small goal and stick to it for several weeks. And the goal of that goal is not the exercise itself. It's to create a habit. So if you haven't exercised, start with a 5-minute brisk walk, with the operative term being brisk. And make sure you stick to that for several weeks. Then make it 7 minutes. Then after several weeks, make it 10 minutes. Before you know it, you have developed the habit of exercise without ever addressing the term motivation. So thank you for that question, because it packs a lot, but it's a good opportunity to teach a lot.
Hmm. And you have a great example in the book about Jerry, a 54-year-old African-American who is overweight. He received a diagnosis of vascular dementia from his primary care doctor and really bristled at the idea of exercising. And you recommended he buy a recumbent bike for his living room. And after 3 months, he and his wife were actually biking outside, and they felt like completely different people just by biking while he was watching television.
Absolutely. I think that was probably one of my favorite stories and encounters. And the reason being, you know, everybody wants to be healthy. Everybody wants to include healthier habits into their life. But if you don't make it convenient, it doesn't really happen. You know, going out to a gym is great, but not a lot of people do it because there's so many impediments in the decision and the action. So if you can minimize that as much as possible, that actually brings success. So having your exercise equipment at home makes a big difference. You know, Jerry was quite motivated, but, you know, he couldn't go because of weather, because of car issues, or just being tired. And by having a recumbent bike, several things were taken care of. First, he didn't have to dress up and go to the gym every day. He could do it in his pajamas. Second, he had some balance issues. And, you know, a recumbent bike takes care of that. He was comfortable. He was sitting in his living room. And that act of, you know, jumping on a recumbent bike and exercising caused him to become more stronger and more motivated to get out of the house and, you know, take part in other activities.
Today we're speaking with Drs. Aisha and Dean Sherzai about their book, The Alzheimer's Solution. They are co-directors of the Brain Health and Alzheimer's Prevention Program at Loma Linda University Medical Center. Thank you for that email. We actually have full lines, so let's try to get through as many as we can. Let's go to Tristan in San Francisco. Hi, Tristan. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My mother has Alzheimer's, and she stopped smoking at 25. She was a teacher until she was 65, very active, never overweight, walked, pretty much a vegan, organic food person her whole life, did everything preventively without knowing that she was doing it, living a great life, exercised the whole thing, and she still got Alzheimer's. And I'm wondering what, I almost feel like it's patient blaming, that she's being blamed for not living perfectly, for getting sick, but she's done everything you're saying to do to not get sick. And she still has Alzheimer's. And it's, I don't know where to go with that.
Well, Tristan, stay on the line in case you have a follow-up.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for that question. First of all, it's we were getting this statement that is this blaming the patient? It's absolutely not blaming the patient. It's like saying that somebody who has heart disease or cancer, and we know the relation between lifestyle and cancer, we know the relationship between lifestyle and heart disease, and the fact that we pointed out that it's a blame. It's not. It's a public health issue. It's an awareness issue. It's a resource issue. We both are public health specialists. It's about resource issues. So it's not about blame, but it's about creating the environment and the situation and information that's convenient to create a healthy lifestyle, not just for dementia, but for all diseases that we know are related to lifestyle. Now, are there times where people have lived a perfect life and they still develop disease? Absolutely. We would be bombastic if we said that there are no cases of people who've lived a perfect life. But I would be, and then other cases where people who've lived horrible lives, then, you know, we get this thing all the time. You say, oh, forget about this. My uncle lived to a ripe old age of 98, and he smoked, and he ate this, and he ate, you know, steaks every day, and so on and so on. Yeah, those are the people at the edge of the bell curve. So you don't create public health.
Well, I have to say this. So I know many women whose mothers have Alzheimer's, and probably 50% had good, healthy, not overweight. They were like my mother, and they still got sick. So I feel it's kind of not right to say 90% of people will be saved from Alzheimer's if they eat right and exercise. Yeah. I just don't feel that's honest. I'm sorry. I just don't, because I see the reality in the world. And it's
sure.
scary.
But we do the research. I've seen... Sure. So not so that doesn't become a point of back and forth. I completely respect your point of view and accept your experience. But having seen this from a community side, we do work at the community levels. We do work on hundreds of churches that we go to. We actually collect data at the community level. We have data at the national level. We do research in the clinic, more than 5,000 patients now. So the anecdotes that we hear are not consistent with the numbers that we see in a well-documented way. The reality is that people who say, let me give you an idea of what people think that they're eating healthy. So everybody we talk to, they say, I eat healthy. And the gambit of what they believe to be healthy is unbelievable. Or even when they say they're vegan. I mean, vegan does not mean that you're healthy. You know, what is it? Oreos are vegan, and chips are vegan, and French fries are vegan. And the reality of the whole food plant-based living has just become evident now. There aren't that many people that have lived a whole food plant-based diet, unprocessed diet, which is low in sugar and low in fat. That's not reality. We know the data. So not blaming people. We're saying that this is the reality. I mean, we know that fat or sugar or any of those processed foods affect the heart. So when we bring it up, does that mean that we're blaming people? Absolutely not. We're just pointing out the data. The data is consistent that when you do have energy dysregulation and lipid dysregulation, which doesn't happen from thin air, it happens as a result of lifestyle or genetics, but mostly lifestyle, then there are consequences, you know, from vascular dementia to all the way to stroke, all the way to, and we believe Alzheimer's as well. So the reality of it is different. And then the other thing is, what we are proposing is not easy in the sense that we're not saying, take a couple of pills here and you'll be fine. Or if you just eat a vegan diet, you're going to be fine. You know, you have to do all of those things. Mm-hmm. If you have sleep apnea, let's say, and you're not treating it, yet you can be eating all the kale on the planet and you're still not going to help your brain. Mm-hmm. You could be running marathons, but yet, if you didn't challenge your brain and didn't create that resilience, and at the same time ate poorly, you're not going to withstand the perils of aging and trauma during aging. So it's two answers to you is, we completely respect your experience and experience of some of the other people that say that they've lived a perfect life. I would say that I would be quite incredulous about that perfection of that life. Second of all, there's no judgment here. There's data that lifestyle affects outcomes. And now there's clearer data when it comes to brain and other diseases that lifestyle is not what we thought we were doing. For example, a lot of people come to me and say, oh, I exercise all the time. Don't worry about that. Don't even bring it up. And I say, what do you do? They say, oh, I walk the neighborhood. I take the dog out. I do gardening all day. I say, that's great, but that's not exercise. That's meditation. The data shows that you have to do quite a bit of exercise, you know, brisk walk or enough to get tired, 25 minutes to 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week. And on top of that, leg exercises, because leg strength has been associated with brain health, and move throughout the day. So I don't know what percentage of the population does that. The American Heart Association has the Simple Sevens showing how adherent we are to good health. American Heart Association data, real data. And whereas we're doing better with smoking, and we're doing better with exercise, and a little bit better with blood pressure, although that's now changing. When it comes to nutrition, guess what percentage of Americans are eating truly healthy diet?
Very low.
0.4%.
Wow.
So if you do the cumulative statistics on this, if 0.4% of people are eating perfectly healthy, what percentage of those are doing perfectly healthy exercise and stress management and sleep hygiene and sleep maintenance, and high level of cognitive activity well beyond their retirement, the numbers would not be the what we think it is. We have a sense of having said that, the data on lifestyle has been there for heart disease, and there's no judgment there. Absolutely, we don't even believe in judgment because it's always input and output. The environmental resources and all those things that we as public health people have to make available. And then now it's available for the brain, the most active organ in the body. This 3-pound organ, 3 pounds, 2% of body's weight, consumes 25% of the energy. If it's an organ that's in a closed environment, blood-brain barrier, and consumes 25% of the energy, don't you think that it would be subject to what we put into it? Or is it magical?
Well, and again, for Tristan, I completely understand your frustration as someone who's currently caregiving. Just briefly, Aisha, do you have any other recommendations that Tristan can do for her mom?
I think at this point, I didn't really catch the stage of her mom's disease. And I'm so sorry to hear that she's going through this stage. It's very hard. I think it's very important for her mom to include lifestyle items around her that will slow down the progression of the disease. There's a lot of data that shows that when people eat a whole food plant-based diet, which is high in unprocessed vegetables and fruits and whole grains, nuts and seeds, they can actually stave off the steep decline in their cognitive status. As well as exercise, sleep is incredibly important. But all of these should be focused on making sure that she's comfortable, that this is not a stressful change in her life, because that stress can actually cause even more damage. And I think more important than anything else is for Tristan to find some time to take care of herself, because caregivers are under a lot of stress and they actually experience more risks for diseases of the heart and the brain compared to patients themselves. So she needs to take some time off and take care of herself.
Well, thank you for calling in, Tristan. Let's go next. Go ahead.
One last thing for Tristan, mm-hmm. because we felt her pain. I was there with my grandmother till the last breath in the same room. I had to take care of her. There's nothing more painful than that. To see the most, the person you love the most just disappearing in small increments in front of your eye. So we completely understand your pain. There's no judgment in this. It's just that we hope that you and others would take this lifestyle message and realize that this affects not just the brain, but the entire body. So Aisha's message is absolutely apt. Take care of yourself and those who are taking care of the family.
Thank you. Let's go next to Renee in Mill Valley. Hi, Renee. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
My mother died at 94. She had a diagnosis. This was 30 years ago. So Alzheimer's was... not so well known. She's from UCLA. I'm 80, and I've had a diagnosis, MCI, at the Neurology Center at UCSF. That's a couple of years ago. I was asking about donepezil, what experience you have had or knowledge of. I certainly agree that exercise, which I do not do as you are describing or as I would like to, because I know how much better I feel at that time. But so I was just asking about what you think of this medication.
Well, thank you for calling, Renee. And before you answer that, can you tell us what is NCI?
Mild cognitive impairment is the diagnosis that is often given in the beginning stages. Part of my problem is that I have been a patient in the neurology center for over a decade on the basis of something called TGI, transglobal amnesia. And so that made me aware of the service. And so like many people who may have problems, they never go for assessment because there isn't any, there's denial, and then there may not be a need for it.
Right.
So I'm complicating things, but it is a function of ongoing assessments.
Thank you, Renee.
Absolutely. Thanks, Renee, for that question and for calling and for expanding on the importance of getting assessed and diagnosed. I completely agree with you. I think a lot of individuals, especially, 65 and above, feel that the small little memory lapses may not be anything. And for the most part, it may not be, but it never hurts to get assessed and find out if it's the early stages of something that is more ominous. In your situation, so mild cognitive impairment is the pre-dementia stage, and it's the most amenable stage for changing the course of the disease. As far as donepezil is concerned, it's not a disease-modifying medication. It helps with the symptoms of memory, and it helps people to a certain extent, not everybody, but some people. What it does is it essentially stabilizes your memory, and you don't suffer as much as far as memory lapses are concerned. But it does not change the course of the disease. It does not change the pathology that is ongoing in the brain. So if it helps you, that's great. Go ahead and take it. It does come with a set of side effects. And so you have to be quite aware of what they are. And if you are suffering from them, then you should get off of the medication because it could complicate things. But in your situation with mild cognitive impairment, one of the most important things that you can do is to start exercising and to really, really push this whole concept of neuronutrition, exercise, unwind or stress management, restorative sleep, and optimizing your cognitive activity. You brought up exercise. There was a research done a few years ago on a set of patients with mild cognitive impairment, and 47% of them were able to reverse their MCI with a regimented exercise program, which focused on aerobic activity, which raises your heart rate, as well as strength training. And so it's critical for you to get into a program. If you've never exercised, maybe join a program, maybe hire a physical trainer. And if there's one exercise that you should focus on, it should be your legs, because leg strength has been associated with brain growth, hippocampus. Hippocampus is an area of the brain that is responsible for encoding memory. And in that research project, the hippocampus actually grew. And there are several other studies that show that the brain grows when people exercise. So there is a big chance for you to completely stop the disease from progressing from here on and even reverse some of the damage that has been done. So good luck to you. And I'm really, really encouraged that you're aware and you're partaking in lifestyle programs.
Well, thank you for the phone call. We're getting a lot of emails about social justice issues because on this show, we talk a lot about inequality, poverty, food deserts where a lot of communities do not have access to fruits and vegetables, let alone organic food. Graham writes, let's put this in the societal context. While we can focus on things individuals can do, we also need to ask why Alzheimer's is so prevalent during this modern era of extreme stress, extreme overwork, exploitation, pollution. He says maybe capitalism is part of the problem. You're both, you do a lot of public health work, and you did a lot of work in nearby San Bernardino, which is a lower income community where the diet is much higher in animal products and processed foods, more sedentary, for so many people who want to do the right thing. I mean, in the Bay Area, the rents are so high. People are living five, eight people in a two-bedroom. They don't have time to do deep breathing. They don't have a space to do it. So what about the social justice aspect of this and what we can do to ensure that everyone has access to these tools, even when they don't cost anything, but because of the situation, they can't do it.
This is at the heart of our passion. This is what we live for. In fact, all the profits of our book goes to Healthy Minds Initiative, which is a non-for-profit we started, which is there just to raise the very issues you just brought up. Because our journey started in Loma Linda when we went and started speaking in churches. In Loma Linda itself, where the Seventh-day Adventists are, they're highly educated. So that cognitive activity is incredibly protective, mental activity. They eat a plant-based diet mostly, and they have the community component. So all of this stuff is very protective. And in my clinic, which should have been inundated with this population, we didn't see a handful of people that had dementia with those qualities. That's the remarkable thing. Out of 3,000 people, we had less than 20 people with those qualities that had dementia, which is profound. Yet when we went to the churches in San Bernardino, and every time we spoke in those low socioeconomic churches, every 65-year-old that used to come to us, we knew they had some measure of cognitive decline and dementia. And it had nothing to do with race. It had nothing. It had to do with access to resources, to good food, to exercise, to mental activity, to stress management, to sleep resources. It had, so the communities were so heterogeneous that it couldn't have been racial alone. It couldn't have been anything else except for access. And access is at the center of this. And this actually flows across all cognitive diseases. We just went to Alaska and for the Healthy Minds Initiative. And in Alaska, we thought we were going to have a community conversation. And usually, our efforts is not just a pamphlet to them. We sit and have conversations. And in Alaska, the dominant issue was suicide among young men and depression and anxiety. And guess what it was? Same thing. Access to food, the proper food, access to social. This is a social justice issue. This has to be raised at that level. I love that question and the awareness that your population is bringing to this.
And Aisha, I just realized the time flew by. We have about 20 seconds. What can we do about it? I mean, we know what we need to do about this in terms of lifting people up, higher wages, access to food. But, I mean, this is happening right now. How are you reaching these communities?
The first thing that we did was create safe space for conversations, communication, and actually raising awareness about this. In our Healthy Minds Initiative, you know, we go to different communities and we have an online presence as well with the digital age. The benefit of having access to, you know, the digital platform is just that, to have conversations with people who can't see you face to face, and to highlight the importance of small, achievable goals in our environments, whether it's our home, office, or at work. That's how it all begins.
And we're going to have to continue this conversation because we were flooded with calls and emails. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of you. Doctors Dean and Aisha Sherzai are authors of The Alzheimer's Solution. Thank you so much for joining us. We'd love to have you back.
It's our pleasure. Thank you for having us, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.